How are you this afternoon?
Fine.
Good. Well, I haven't a blessed thing to talk to you about. Nothing. The after-dinner speaker, you know, who prepared the tremendous speech and then got up, and when he got up, the speech sat down. Well, I'm a little better off than he, since I didn't prepare a speech, so there's no speech to sit down. But there are possibly a few minor items about which we could talk without the tremendous formality of lecturing, you know. Professional lecturing is a very interesting activity, extremely interesting. A professional lecturer is one who gets up and says with great conviction things he is not even vaguely convinced about. But he says them with great conviction. Down in Hyde Park, there is here and there a speaker's stand with an enormous number of people standing around. And I hear fellows down there saying things that nobody could believe. There's nobody, I mean. I know they don't believe it. And crowd, by its reaction, certainly doesn't believe it. But great oddity. Since Scientology, there is one speaker in Hyde Park who's an exception to that rule. A very fine speaker. He always has a quiet, orderly crowd around him that doesn't heckle him. Stands there, listens to him, appreciates what he says. When he's finished, they thank him. Two or three come around and say, well, now you certainly helped me out. And they go away. Great difference there. Right down the line, there's speaker speaking for something else. And he has what you might call colloquially a pitch. He has a curve. He himself isn't convinced what he's talking about, and therefore he has to prepare a speech with great care. Because he might make a slip. He might open his mouth and something might come out that isn't quite according to the proper line that has been tailored. But that's not true of this other speaker. And people never heckle him, and he never prepares his speeches either. He's probably the only speaker down there that is fully and completely accepted unreservedly. The thing he's talking about, I read the other day in a popular American picture paper magazine, a thing called Scientology. And maybe for the first time, we don't have to carefully prepare our speeches because we might make a slip. Because they were not trying to convince anybody of anything. And all we're convinced of ourselves is of our own good intentions in trying to get our job done. Well, that speaker down there in Hyde Park's been doing a tremendously good job. A very good job. You would be amazed how many people from how many quarters of the world come and listen to him. You would be utterly amazed. Looking over his audience, we find people from Africa, from India, from over on the continent, from up in the Scandinavian countries. And here and there, I believe, probably on the outskirts, we could probably locate a Russian or two. I know I've seen an Arab. Those people stand there and they listen and they say, this is very strange. This is something I have never heard of before. Somebody with an honest attention and intention to the problems of man. And they go away. Well, I won't tell you what they say in their countries, but they must say something. Because that speaker started talking 3 years ago. And now the Hubbard Association of Scientologists International has an office on every continent of Earth. It is probably the most widespread, widely accepted organization on earth today, since it is accepted by all contending parties. The very people who are talking alongside of this man in Hyde Park are at violent odds one with the other. But nobody is at odds with Scientology unless they themselves have some vested interest in holding down and controlling slaves. But these men have no argument with this speaker in Hyde Park. So I've been hammering a typewriter, and he's been speaking in Hyde Park. We've been assaulting the citadels of ignorance, and we've all been winning. And I'd like to take this opportunity to give that speaker in Hyde Park a very big hand. Thank you. We have him at the fantastic disadvantage of not being able to say a single word in rebuttal.
What you think?
He did, didn't he? You just can't stop him from talking. I want to talk to you today very specifically about how good you can get. How good Dianetics and Scientology have been able to make people. I'm going to talk to you today very honestly. There are people around who have exaggerated what can be done with Dianetics and Scientology back through the years in the frame of reference of the exact reality of the practitioner. Now, these men have exaggerated unknowingly. But exaggeration was there. It was there because an insufficient number of practitioners, skilled men, were trained in order to do what the subjects could do. And therefore, claims which were not attained by these people were exaggerated claims. They were exaggerated in 1950. Simply because these results could not immediately occur in the hands of those people who were doing the job. And they could not immediately occur, from my viewpoint, because I had several jobs to do. Furthermore, in 1950, we did not have group processing. In 1950, we had many people interested, few of them skilled. And therefore, majority claims of Dianetics as of 1950 were exaggerated. Fantastically, a fact that anything like this is the work of a team. It is not the work of one man. It can't be. Now, I may sit up in the ivory towers of thought and pound on a somewhat less than ivory typewriter and dream beautiful dreams. But the actuality is that when the dream has been dreamed, it has to fit in somewhere into the framework of humanity before it is any good to anybody. So therefore, it isn't enough to dream a beautiful dream or write an enthusiastic sentence. We have to have people to know those things, to add to them, and with their own skill and sincerity and learning to back them up and act with them and bring about with them a reality. That's what is necessary. And at no time during this entire activity has Dianetics or Scientology been other than the work of a team. A team of very good people, a team for the most part of very splendidly intentioned people. Their only shortcomings, I'm afraid to a large degree I was responsible for by not putting into their hands everything I knew as fast as I knew it, but then there is this matter of there only being 28 hours in a day. face that reality. Nevertheless, a claim I would make had to be a claim for the team, didn't it? It had to be binding on everybody if it were not an exaggerated claim. If everybody couldn't back up and produce the result spoken about by myself or by somebody else, then it was an exaggeration. Am I right? Well, I myself, in my enthusiasm, had overlooked probably about 30% of humanity. These cussed, ornery, vicious people who simply sit there and say, I'm not going to survive no matter what you do. And when with great adventurousness I claimed a totality for Dianetics, I was doing something that scientists are in the habit of doing, and that is taking some section of the field and simply moving it out of my own sight and saying, this isn't there, you know. Cures everybody who wants to be cured. Big difference. This 30% was of great interest. Maybe it was higher than that in the earlier days. But what exactly did Dianetics do in my hands and in the hands of this team of good fellows? What did it do? What is the fact? The fact is that it cured about 60 or 70% of the chronic illnesses it addressed. That's the fact of the matter. In the 70% of humanity that wanted them cured. Now, you got that figure? 60 or 70% in the 70% that wanted to get well. If and when they walked up to a practitioner, an auditor, and said, do something for me. Well, the only reason we went on at all is because that is better than had been done before. But a statement that Dianetics could deal satisfactorily as a team of good fellows working together with 100% of man's ills was, for that moment in time, an exaggeration, a thing which was borne out by our experience, not a thing which was weighted beforehand. So we had to know more, and we had to get better people, didn't we? These people, we had to get people who knew more. We had to teach the people we already had more. Very great problems of finance, research, problems of compiling results, problems of relaying this information to people, were actually more important than the actual results themselves, since we were getting results. Now, what is the real average result in the field of healing? Now, I don't mean by these to slam or throw aside or cast any aspersion of any kind against the professional healer. He worked with his tools, he was a team, and we now are part of the team of healers. Whether we have a brass plate hanging up on Harley Street, overt act against medicine, they're going to wake up one of these days, by the way, they're going to be driving to work in their Jaguar or something of the sort, and they're going to look up and they're going to see great big sign up there. So-and-so, HPA, consulting Scientologist. We're taking bids right now to get a big enough brass plate. And that brass plate, by the way, isn't going to be there in contest with medicine. It's there to say, we will help you out too, and we expect you to help us out. And if they don't, we'll process them till they do. But in no wise is this a criticism. It's merely the offering of a statistic which is borne out by the more honest data given to us by healing professions. And now, you can understand that healing professions include a very great number of activities and practices, and not just medical. The figure is 22% of the illnesses offered cured. Now you say, is that 22% for homeopathy? Is that 22% for chiropractic? Is that 22% for medicine? Is it 22% for psychoanalysis? What is it? No, it's 22% for all of them. That's the average. 22%. When I was a boy, I had a lot to do with some of the more barbaric places of Earth. I don't mean, by the way, Brooklyn. And I'm certainly not talking about Liverpool. But down in the depths of this jungle or that, we had and have today a great many savage tribes. And just because they're running around in breech clouts doesn't mean they don't get sick. They do get sick. They get sick of all kinds of illnesses and ailments. They're most remarkably human. I don't care if they hunt for heads or if they find the most satisfactory dish to be putrefied fish, it doesn't matter. They are still human beings, and they respond to the same rules as other human beings. And I had some friends when I was a lot younger. They were shamans, witch doctors, nothing more nor less. And I did a little addition on the thing, and they were 22% effective. Just exactly. And the other day I was reading a medical bulletin put out by a drug house which had looked over all of the various ramifications, and it announced a figure perilously close to this figure, 23.5%. It's an oddity, isn't it? I mean, we got a figure here, it's a constancy. Well, I invite you, if you're interested in research, to go and look up this figure, because it is simply too constant not to be inspected by somebody. But from that figure, we can assume that if treated and given the interest of a practitioner in any field of human assistance, the 22% of the people respond to it and get well invariably, no matter what they're treated with. Follow me? In other words, there's a percentage of humanity that gets well. And it's 22% of humanity. If you took the figures in a hospital and went through them very carefully, you would find that very close to a total cure, and this is what we're talking about, not a relapsing, stagger-along condition, but very close to a total cure was achieved in 22% of the people admitted to that hospital. We go down to an insane asylum, oddly enough, and we find out the percentage is more or less holding good there. All I'm telling you is that one had to better this percentage very, very markedly before he could make a statement that Dianetics was doing a thing. Follow me? 22% had to be cured. And then what was Dianetics doing? It was doing anything in advance of 22%. Did it do anything in advance of 22%? Yes, it did. We could count on its going up to about 50. Just count on that. And therefore, it was better than man had been doing, and so it was worth doing. In my own statements, I'm supposed to be an incurable optimist. I am not part of the 22%. And I would state this and that, and very often it would concern cases that were very close in, series of maybe 5 or 6, and they did recover, and I would assume optimistically, but the percentage was higher than that. Well, it was a mistake, but it kept me going. That was one bonus. But it upset a lot of people, too. They'd been led to believe by my facile pen that all they had to do was walk up to an auditor and he would make some sort of a magic sign over their medulla oblongata, and they would promptly assume a state never heard of before in the midst of man. And about 50% of them did. And the other 50% said, as a social opinion, aw, nuts. And we kept going and moved into 1951. There was more research and more investigation and more cases. And we were getting to be, and this is what is important, a better team. We knew more about each other. There were more people out in the public joining us. We were getting smarter. We're getting more experience. And my incurable optimism kept on. And the next thing you know, we were getting about 55 or 60%. But that's a pretty good gain for a year, isn't it? In view of the fact that we've always got 22% who will walk up and get cured. Pitchman standing on the street can sell pills that maybe taste a little better to convince somebody. And do you know that 22% of the people who buy those pills will get well of whatever he says? It's wonderful. But we had added 5% more to our 50 in a year. And then came 1952. We worked hard. And we were getting to be a better team, and the results were coming up. And I realized something, that no great advance in research had made this gain. The gain had been made by better training amongst the people who read and studied. The book auditors, the professional auditors, the school auditors, all these people, just the people casually interested, they were getting to know more about the thing. Furthermore, they were getting more familiar with my intentions, and I was getting more familiar with their intentions. Very often, I thought their intentions were better than they thought mine were. But where did we have any possible permission to go on? That additional 5% we'd added in a year. Let's add to it a little more. In 1953, we had. We're getting so in 1953 that we could fairly well count on somebody walking in with some sort of a chronic somatic or some sort of an ailment of one kind or another, and fairly well count on reducing it so that he didn't worry about it anymore. I mean, we could pretty well count on doing that. It'd be an oddity if this didn't happen, except for a certain percentage of people who never walked up and asked. That 30% that never walk up and ask. I all of a sudden realized with a shock that that 30% was missing, and we could go no higher than 70 because the 30 would never walk in and say, please. So 70% would be absolute height, tops. But in this 30%, we missed. We continued to miss. We also missed, remember, a certain percentage of the people who were right in there begging. 1954 came along, and for the first time, we found out how to train a person in Dianetics and Scientology. For the first time, we found out how to train one. We found out why training was difficult and why there were often splinter schools arising in every forward endeavor in the field of the mind or in healing. We discovered this. We discovered it right in Scientology itself. And we discovered at the same time something we always more or less known, but we really discovered it this time, and that is we had the cure for each ailment and ill Scientology had as a broad social movement. And if we could just find out what was wrong with Scientology as a broad social movement, then we could find out in Scientology what would cure it. Interesting thing, you know? Self-curing mechanism. Took another look at this. This is a very surprising thing. A self-disentangling mechanism. A self-disinturbulating mechanism. Well, it seemed to me to be quite important. Here was something that could settle its own troubles. If it was honest enough to look at those troubles. And perhaps even in 1954, there was still a failure to look at all of the troubles. Just like an auditor has greater hopes for the pre-clear than the pre-clear has ordinarily. So, we had an optimistic view of how many and how great our troubles were. They were many and great, believe me. Because the moment we discovered why people couldn't learn and discovered how to correct this, we suddenly found that hardly anybody had ever been doing Dianetics or Scientology. Everybody was doing something a little different than everybody else. The answer to that was duplication, a part of the communication formula. An inability to duplicate. We take a line of soldiers, we stand them up in a long row, and we whisper into the ear of the first one. We say, the attack starts at midnight. And he turns around and he whispers the same message to the fellow next to him. And when we get down to the last soldier, we ask him what the message was. Now, that's been relayed about 12 times. We ask him what the message was, and he says, you'd better polish the captain's boots. Now, how did he get that disarranged? By the time it got out here to number 12, it was not even recognizable as the same message. Well, that was an inability on the part of each one. No matter how slight, it was an inability to duplicate. And we discovered, strangely enough, that an individual could recognize life and evaluate the factors of life to the degree that he himself was willing to approximate what he saw in life. And if he was willing to approximate what he saw in life, then he could understand all of life. But he never was able to understand those things he was himself not willing to participate in. Follow me? It's quite one thing to have a dirty city. It's quite another thing to have an impulse to clean up the city. And it's entirely something else to get it cleaned up. Do you know why it doesn't get cleaned up if it doesn't? It doesn't get cleaned up because people look at all that dirt and they say, no, no, no. No. It's horrible. I refuse to have anything to do with that dirt. Who sweeps it then, huh? Nobody's ever going to have anything to do with this dirt. Nobody's ever willing to get down and scrub at this dirt. Nobody's ever willing to contact it or be dirty because of it for the length of time necessary to clean it up. It will never be cleaned. People are unwilling to duplicate the dirt. The city will stay filthy. You see, it's just unwillingness. Somebody relaxes and said, well, let's have a clean town. Look at all the dirt. A bunch of guys say, well, okay, roll up the sleeves. They get filthy in the process. They clean up the town, bright, burning. They clean themselves up. We've got a clean town. See how it works? Well, an unwillingness or an inability to duplicate is really the single bar to learning. People will not learn if they cannot or will not duplicate. A person in good shape is willing to be duplicated and is willing to duplicate and is also willing not to duplicate and willing not to be duplicated. Those four conditions must be answered before a person is in fine condition. Therefore, he's doing all this by choice, isn't he? And we found out that the mechanism of non-duplication came about from painful accidents, from difficulties and worries and fears which were so grave and so great that an individual said they must never, never, never happen again. And if an individual said they must never happen again, he didn't participate in life to just that extent. He was still holding something out in front of him here saying, that must never happen again. And eventually he was left with a great many such things stacked up all in front of him here, out away from him, telling him that these things must never, never happen again. And you know what the end result of that is? Life must never happen again. That's an unwillingness to duplicate life, and we found a cure for it. It is a crude, vicious, terrible process that auditors all over the world were willing to shoot me for. It was called, colloquially, Dirty 30. And it had a remarkable result. As rough as it was, it still brought people into a condition where they said, look, there are some things that can happen again. Its proper name is opening procedure by duplication. When you make a person walk over to a book and examine it in a certain way, and then set it down and walk over to a bottle and examine it in a certain way, and put it down and walk over to the book, and pick it up, and examine it in a certain way, and put it down, and walk over to the bottle, and examine it in a certain way, and put it down, and walk over to the book, and pick it up, and examine it in a certain way, and put it down, and walk over. Is anybody getting nervous? That was Dirty 30. On some auditors, it was run for 45 or 50 hours. This was real murder, too, because in some cases it was far too high or advanced a process for their cases. It was far too rough. Nevertheless, after it had been done, after they worked it on each other, they themselves were willing to be duplicated. They were willing to sit there and be in fairly good shape and have the pre-clear get into good shape. They themselves were fairly willing to make statements which they didn't mind if somebody else stated, just like that. And they themselves were particularly willing to pick up Scientology and look at it as it was, and if they did vary it in any way, to vary it totally, consciously. They knew they were varying it. It wasn't any longer an obsessive thing to change it in some fashion. And all of a sudden, it got much more workable. And because it became much more workable, another factor appeared which had been continually in evidence but now became very plain to the eye. And that factor was, how long does it take to bring about a result with Dianetics or Scientology? How long does it take with Dianetics to bring about anything like a very high-level result required at least 500 hours of processing? It's an awfully long time. Do you realize that's 5 hours a day for 100 days? We just didn't have that many people. We just didn't have that many hours. We did petition to the Greenwich Observatory down here to run us in a few more hours, but they wouldn't do it. And in 1954, we had drawn a curve of advance which had reduced processing down, probably for pretty good results, down to about 125, 150 hours. We could get certainly better results in that length of time than we could have gotten in 1950, in 500 hours. We certainly could get better results by then. And now people started to get more results faster because they themselves had a willingness to be duplicated, a willingness to communicate, a willingness to learn, a willingness to teach, a willingness to originate themselves and send it along to me. In other words, we went into better ARC, affinity, reality, and communication with one another just because of this one fact. This was an odd thing to do. It could have been applied with greater duress. I mean, there could have been a much more arduous carry forward in an effort to accomplish the total goal of opening procedure by duplication, but it wasn't necessary. Everybody was willing, and there were a lot of people who didn't do it, and so forth. But nevertheless, we could see the entire field of Scientology spark up and become much better because of this. And the results were getting better because of this. But I was still over-optimistic. My 1950 statements and the statements of others in 1950 were still too optimistic. We couldn't possibly carry forward the goals of Dianetics and Scientology to the entire world if we did not have a better method than individual application. Individual application would defeat us. Let's say that there were a larger number than there are. Let's say there are a much larger number than there are. Let's say 10,000 active, skilled Scientologists in the world. And let's say that each one worked on everybody he could as fast as he could, in chain fashion. There are 10,000 auditors. 2 billion people are there to be worked on. Oh, no. To raise the entire tone of man would have been an unthinkably long and impossible task. Particularly since we had these 30% standing over here who would never come up and ask. And who knows, if we went out into barbaric countries, if the number wouldn't have become 100% of heading for the hills because a new witch doctor had showed up that was going to mesmerize or petrify everybody. The number who were not available to be processed could be. So a statement that we were just going to raise the tone scale of the whole world was just far, far too ambitious because the mechanics of it were impossible. The number of people working and the number of people to be worked on, all of this. So that's an impossible goal. Obviously an impossible goal. Nothing could be done about it. Even if everybody came in and said, please, I'd like to be in better affinity with my fellow man. Please, I'd like my particular village to be in much better shape. Please, I'd like to see some of these illnesses man has sort of damped down. Wouldn't have mattered. We still couldn't have made the grade with individual auditing. We didn't have the facilities, the finance, or anything else. Would have been impossible. Utterly impossible. But all of a sudden, we had effective group auditing. And the moment we had that, we knew we had the world by at least one pole. Because it doesn't matter how many people there are in a group. I have processed hundreds of people at the same time and could as easily have processed thousands. In other words, we could have brought up their alertness and their affinity and reality and communication with one another almost nations at a crack. So this was wiped out as an improbability, and it gave everybody a large burst of enthusiasm, not because we wanted to rush out and see everybody made into a Scientologist, but because we saw something in the world we didn't particularly enjoy observing. And that was a breakdown of international relations and the introduction into the society of weapons so great that no individual could contest them. And this was important then. We said, well, we have an answer here. We have an answer, and it's pretty good. Maybe we can do something with this answer. Maybe by just telling people about this. Maybe by just the fact that there, people might be led to hope a little bit that there is an answer, we could be doing something about this. And our group auditing became rather successful. Strange things happen in groups. A person who has been processed by a professional auditor auditing a group for a few hours, all of a sudden you get people who are seeing and walking and doing various things they weren't able to do before. It's not tremendously spectacular from a standpoint of the Scientologist, But it's awfully spectacular with relationship to that 22%. We're bettering the 22% recovery today with group auditing. It's probably up around 50. The group auditing result is today as good as individual practice in Dianetics 5 years ago. Now, that's an advance, isn't it? But as I say, still being too optimistic. The team still didn't know everything they're supposed to know. The team counted on me, and I only had a 35-hour day, and they only had a 26-hour day. Various difficulties arose, not amongst us, but just how are we going to take care of everything we had to do and keep going somehow and keep things squared around? How were we going to do this? Well, in 1950, actually, I had had part of this answer. And in 1955, this very year, a fantastic thing occurred. We became sufficiently able to start picking up this 30% out here that never would have walked in and knocking their silly heads off as fast as they wanted to walk up. We could talk to them, we could persuade them, and just by talking to them about their unwillingness to have anything done for them, we did something for them. Oh, that's a sneaky one, isn't it? If they'll just come around and tell us why they don't want any Scientology, we've got them. Beautiful, beautiful technology. So we made an inroad for the first time in the history of man of the fellow who will not walk up to the witch doctor's hut or the medical doctor's brass plate. He's usually willing to explain why nothing can be done for him. That's all he's got to do to us. And we got him. Now, with this, a tremendous advance in technology occurred. A new big advance in technology. We found a couple of little factors that didn't seem to be awfully important before that really were the factors that led the whole parade. And as soon as we knew those two little factors, we could do in 25 hours of auditing on most of the cases who came around, certainly 50% of the cases or 60% of the cases came around, we could do more in 25 hours of individual auditing than we had been able to do with 1,000 hours in 1950. And that was advance. Only this time, there was a greater percentage. You see what we're digging into here? We're digging more and more into the realm of former impossibilities. That's the target. And we just make this former impossibility a possible. And then we go a little deeper in. And every time that we reached a little deeper into the totality of man, something new occurred. We did better with the fellow who was walking right up to us saying, yes sir, would you want to audit me, huh? How about it? I haven't got very much wrong with me. I just want to be clear. Well, you know, this fellow always ought to have gotten the same ratio. See, we always ought to have been able to do the same amount for him each time. But that isn't what was happening. This fellow, 25 hours, and he'd had it now. Big, big jump. Now, having suffered from 5 years of optimism, which is one of the deadlier ills, I decided to take my medicine for it and make the optimism pay off by making it right. But it meant some work. So we reached out in the United States to any case we could reach that had been a failed case in the HASI clinic. And I mean by fail, we didn't do everything for them that they hoped we would do. That was the definition of a failed case. We didn't do everything they hoped we'd do. We reached out for each one of these cases, and we brought them in, and we gave them a week, and we turned them away with more having been done for them than they ever hoped could have been done. And that was a sigh of relief. That was a sigh of relief to us in the center in the United States, and is right this minute turning into a sigh of relief for us here in Great Britain. Because there are cages around that came up and said, please make me a more able person. And they were audited, and they got a little bit more able. And they were not sure that they had arrived at any optimum level. Not sure at all. And we were very far from sure. We knew they hadn't. Now, in view of the fact that our target had changed slightly, the target in 1950, and in Dianetics is the body, the target in 1955 is the person himself, that beingness, that awareness, which is the being. Target had changed, but we could do more by changing the target for the body the same way than we could have before by just addressing the body. And it was a very important thing in the United States that we would reach out and pull in people who were, quote, failed cases, whose cases had not been included in my optimism. And pull them in and say, here you go. Sit down there. We'll have an auditor in here. Here we go. And straighten the fellow up. You have no idea what that did for my morale. You mean I didn't have to be optimistic anymore? It was a sort of a loss to me when I realized that. As you mean, everything you're going to say now is not going to be supported by any hope even on your part. That doesn't seem reasonable. That's no way to go about it. That's too dully factual. Getting too statistical. Well, in view of that, let's just raise the whole goal structure. And let's find out if we can't produce this same result on masses of people. And right here today in Great Britain, that is under experiment. How to make, it sounds fantastic, how to make a stable theta clear, as we call an individual in very fine condition, how to make a stable theta clear out of at least 75 members of a group undergoing 30 hours of group processing. Now, we've got that under test right this minute. We have hopes. It may not materialize. We only may get 30% of them, you know. Maybe several of the others will need individual address to their problems. Because once more, knowing what you can do and everybody in the team knowing what you can do are two different things. You see that? Nevertheless, right today, the auditors in Great Britain are experiencing a considerable resurgence of hope on this thing. In fact, they are getting insufferably cocky. But this is a penalty you pay for success. We'll find some way to do something about this, but the great hope right now of all of our endeavors is that we will be able to do for anybody who walks up, and we will be able to reach out and grab hold of everybody that never heard of us and have him tell us why it is he doesn't want any auditing. And this would be a fantastic thing, wouldn't it, if we could actually call our shots in the society and by individual auditing pick up these more reluctant cases and by group auditing at least considerably improve the easy ones. Well, now today we even no wise dispensed with the individual auditor.
Actually, the only real way I know of with any certainty to get any place is with individual attention. I mean, we can be sure of that today. We couldn't have been sure of that a year ago. But today we can be sure of that. The chaps today who are well-trained, well-informed, and they are, we're all agreed pretty well on what we're doing. The very deep insight of these people is necessary for particularly these very reluctant cases. And anybody could get any place in 30 hours of group processing and probably get as far in about 5 of individual processing. That may not be very far. You see, we don't know what this figure is yet. We just hope. Remember, I just told you this group processing is a hope. But, oh, what we can do today on this, from the standpoint of individual processing, I just haven't. I never dreamed that I could, you know, say this and just relax, you know, good roads, good living. Go see Joe. They walk in that door, you know, looking horrible. And they walk out that door looking very good. And if they look too much this way, we say, now, wait a minute. We're going to have another door with a black beast in it down there that we'll send them to for a recheck. We don't want them getting too bad. This is a tremendously relaxed thing to occur. And frankly, I am taking this occasion right here now to make actually the first announcement of this fact. To say that the day of over-optimism for the individual case is over, as far as Hubbard is concerned, and he's very happy that it is. He's been holding so many people up with hope, his is about cracked through. Now, what exactly can... let's be very conservative. Let's assume that there are a lot of factors here that we haven't particularly considered. Let's assume that the case is pretty rough or averagely rough or something. And let's assume also any misalliance or, you know, upset in the team itself. And let's assume all these factors. Then what could happen in 75 hours? Let's just choose that factor because we know that that is safe by maybe 50-100%, you see. It's a funny thing, but the cases that walk in saying, nothing wrong with me, you know. You can cure all me up in 3 minutes. They're incurably optimistic, too, believe me. Hey, these boys are quite interesting. The fellows are liable to walk in to better their ability that can't see the wall, you know. And they think their ability is terrific. All they want helped out a little bit maybe is their reaction time. They can't even hold their head on straight. An ordinary pays attention to this. It's just all in the business. He just goes ahead. What could happen in 75 hours of processing today that we could actually feel was justified? Let's take a date which wraps it all up. Let's say the 1st of December, 1955. Let's just take that date because that makes a little closer teamwork possible. That just puts it a little bit ahead. So nobody is standing out ignorant of something. December 1st, 1955, 75 hours of processing. Well, we could pretty well guarantee that an individual would be a stable exterior with full perception or close to full perception. And he'd be awful relaxed about life. And his body would be in as good a condition as could be expected in view of the fact he is living in the physical universe. The body would be in as good a condition as could be expected. That is to say, if someone walks in who doesn't have any arms, you're certainly not going to grow arms for him, that's all. Maybe you could teach him how to mock up arms. We've grown length on arms. We've grown lengths on legs. We've taken withered arms and made them grow and all kinds of things like this. But somebody who just didn't have any arm at all, we're not quite sure whether we know in the general expectancy that we would not give him another arm. But at the same time, he wouldn't have a ghost arm there nagging him, and he would have enough ability with his other hand and arm to, in some measure, compensate for it, don't you see? So we could do something, even about a factor like that, but it wouldn't be the factor of giving him a body which is 21 years old, which will pass the highest rank test pilot flight physical thing. We wouldn't do that. But in the reality of what he has been through, he would be startling as a medical exhibit. This is the only thing we could say. He'd merely be startling that this much change had taken place in his physical beingness. That is to say, we then take somebody who was 75 and he wasn't able to see and his heart was bad and so on. After we processed him, probably all we'd have would be somebody who was 65 who had a good heart. You get the idea? We wouldn't have a 21-year-old boy. Let's not get that enthusiastic. All right. Now, although we did process one of these recently in Washington, and he went down the street whistling at the girls, 75. Well, that's called within the margin of optimism. But are there any more important things that would happen in this 75 hours? We have not for many months failed to lift somebody's intelligence quotient as much as 25 points. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is an impossibility in the frame of reference of all man's prior thinking and work on the subject. Mr. Doakes walks in. He already has an IQ of 150. And we give him 25 to 75 hours of processing, and he has an IQ of 175. Oh, no, 175 is genius. They don't get born in this society all the time. No, they don't, but it's about time somebody made some. Now, there's another level which is quite untouchable, and that is the moron level. A person walks in with an IQ of 70, you know? That's real smart. That's real smart. They look at something, and they have a real intelligent look on their face, and they say, huh? And you say, now, get in this car and drive down to the grocery store, and they'd probably be able to manipulate the gears just right as long as the traffic lights didn't snap against them or something like that, at which time they become very confused and sit there rather dazedly. Somebody's real stupid, in other words. What would we do with this fellow? We would boost his IQ practically the same amount, which is the oddity. We haven't any idea how high IQ can go, but we know we've exceeded existing tests. Now, to raise the intelligence of a moron to 95 IQ from 70 IQ is supposed to be one of the tough impossibilities of all impossibilities, and it's gotten routine in Scientology. It's a routine that the other day I bawled an auditor out. I said, you couldn't possibly have run the processes. And he said, why? I said, you only got a 20-point IQ rise on this person. Process this person for a week? What have you been doing? Only 20-point rise? I didn't realize how ridiculous it was till he looked at me, and they don't take my barks very seriously. They know my bite's much worse than my bark, but but that I never bite. And he started to laugh at me, and he says to me, you just realize what you've said. He said, you have just called me down and bawled me out for doing something that is not possible in any medical or mental textbook in existence. And he says, not only that, you have bawled me out for only doing a miracle. And I kept straight face. I said, of course. Who do you think you are, a saint? Your work's got to come up to par. Well, that's a fantastic and interesting fact, that we are only doing miracles these days along that line. What happens to their physical activity, the reaction time? These things come up accordingly. We're building a new race. That's the only conclusion that we can possibly reach, is that we're building a new race. And all I want to do is ask you for your cooperation. Thank you.